This is Ken Hill, recorded at his home in King's Lynn, Norfolk, by Chris Alden Lee on the 2nd of September 2010. Ken Hill, Part 2.
Let's talk a bit about viewpoint, if you may, Ken, because you eventually got there, and at that point I think the hut was still being built, wasn't it?
No, it had recently been built when I arrived there with Nick Nichols. But the hut had been brought in, excuse me, the hut had been delivered when the Shackleton was there, and I helped to offload it onto the rocks of Viewpoint, which was a very long and tedious and knuckle-stripping process. But by the time I got round there with Nick Nichols, it had been finished. There were various bits that needed to be done a bit later, but largely it was okay. But the journey to Viewpoint was my first introduction to sledging, and the first time I attempted the journey with Jim Madel. With David Larmore from Northern Ireland.
George Larmore,
yeah. He and I set off, and we were away for 3 or 4 days, and we didn't make it. George had done the trip before, and it was a bit misty, and we missed the route down from the mountains to the north side of Deuce Bay, and we ended up on a glacier to one side of the crossing point, and we realized that we were not doing very well, so we decided to camp, which we did on glare ice, which was very tricky. And that night was one of the worst I've ever spent, because the glacier was moving infinitesimally, of course, but each time there was a crack in the ice, and they weren't regular, and you would try and doze off, and there'd be a new crack, and then there'd be another one 90 seconds later, and then a gap of 3 minutes. So it was every crack fed your imagination about this glacier is actually moving, because we didn't know how far we were from the edge. Totally irrational thoughts. Your mind was arguing one thing, but your body was fighting it with more horrendous thoughts. And we were very lucky, and we were very glad to see the dawn when we could actually assess where we were, and we decided to go back. But that took a couple of days, and we spent one night in an Argentine refugio, which had been stacked up with boxes of food, and there was, it was glare ice, and we'd already broken several tent pegs trying to get them into the ice, so we slept inside the refugio in the gap between the boxes of food and the roof, just a single plank wooden hut in very low temperatures and high winds, and George got a little frost nip on his ear, which he didn't know about until blister burst and the liquid ran down his neck. So it was pretty hairy, and when we eventually decided to head for home. And we got there, and we were very relieved to get back, and I think they were quite relieved to see us as well, because we were not terribly experienced at sledging and camping on ice. So that was pretty hairy, but the second time, I think it took 2.5 hours for the whole trip, and we were in a party of 2 or 3 sledges anyway. So that was great. But that experience was unique, to be in a small hut with one other person for a month. I mean, there were other people coming and going during that time, but that was interesting because you don't normally have that experience to live, unless you're married, I suppose. But even then, you're doing different things. But if you're with one other person in a hut 24 hours a day for a month, it's an experience which is unique, as I said, and teaches you things about what you do and what other people do, and the sort of interaction that makes it all, makes it's just one of the other things that makes up life, really.
Was there a kind of a pattern to that relationship during the month? Did it go through sine waves of good moments and bad moments, or?
I can't remember any pattern about it. No, I think at one stage I must have annoyed Nick very, very much because he was a smoker and I wasn't at that time. And I used to wake him up with a cup of coffee and a lit cigarette. And I can't imagine now why I did that. Or how he didn't thump me on the head. But no, it was amicable all the time, really.
What was the value of viewpoint in the hut? Why was it important?
It was another meteorological base manned only during the summer, but it obviously gave some perspective to the weather reporting. It was also a stopover point for sledging parties going south. And during my time there, Ron Werswick and Wally Herbert did quite an extensive surveying trip to the south. But I don't know as to the value of the hut to the survey, I'm not sure, apart from those things.
I gather the view was quite spectacular across Deuce Bay.
Yes. Yes, it was a big bay with mountains all round it. So, and depending on the weather, of course, but that's another great thing. The weather's constantly changing, and you never see. Well, I wasn't really conscious of having the same weather conditions twice, except maybe if it's just very low mist.
So to get there, you were sledging with dogs, I imagine.
Yes.
We haven't talked about dogs yet, but there is some remarkable... I think it's the first time I've seen colour film of a dog team from behind, i.e. shot from a sledge.
Right.
What was your... How did you get on with the dogs? Did you have much to do with them?
Not a great deal. I've still got a scar on my little finger from when I tried to separate fighting huskies with my hands, and I was very soon told that you don't interrupt fighting huskies with hands, only with feet. I enjoyed driving them, learning the commands, and I just couldn't believe how keen and eager the dogs were to be travelling, I think it probably shows in my film, because I took a lot of footage of the puppies and of the sledging, which was a bit tricky. had to leave the sledge and film for a while. I mean, there's nothing staged during my film of sledging. It happened and stop and then run like hell to catch up again afterwards. But yes, I did enjoy the dogs. They did. I think everybody appreciates that they fulfill a role in that kind of situation. They are affectionate and you can stroke them and things like that, which is something you wouldn't otherwise do.
So you view the dogs with a sense of affection too?
Yeah.
Mm. So when there were tragedies in the dogs, I mean, I think you had several dogs die as being strangled in ropes whilst fighting or
pups. Yes, not making it. Yes, we lost a dog on that first trip to Deuce Bay. It just got out of its harness and disappeared down a crevasse. We could hear it, but it was clearly a long way away. We didn't have the skills to go down and get it. So we just left it there.
How do you balance that sense of affection and in the same way that perhaps nurses have a duty of care towards their patients, but they have to keep a distance? I wonder whether you felt the same dilemma with dogs, because they were working animals and...
Yes, we were aware that they would never be pets. Puppies, maybe, I don't know. They were more accessible and playful than the adults. But, we were conscious. We were obviously told at some stage that these are working dogs and you don't treat them like pets.
But you had to train them, I guess, the new ones, the pups that came through.
There seemed little need for training. They seemed to take naturally to it. It's another thing that surprised me. The puppies see the adults pulling sledges, I guess that's part of it. But there was never a point, I didn't see a point anyway, where a puppy was put into a team for the first time and it just stood there. When the other dog started pulling, away it went, and pulling for all it was worth.
You were testing out, I think you were the first team to test out ropes made from nylon. Do you remember that?
Not at all. Okay. I remember having a plastic covering over the runners of the sledges, which was a new venture, a new kind of plastic.
How was that?
Seemed to work very well, yeah. It was like formica. Although I obviously haven't driven sledges without that kind of thing, with straight wooden runners, but certainly seemed to work very well.
And there's a surprising amount of transferring your dogs from base to base. Were you aware of that?
Yes, during the summer, moving teams from one place to another. That was always exciting because you had to get them into the scow, the sort of barge, take them out to the ship, and that was fraught with excitement.
I'm not clear why the dogs were moving around so much, but
I think probably the sledging program said that we'll do this island this summer, so they would take a team and a sledge over.
Right. Okay. Good. Did the blues ever hit Hope Bay whilst you were there?
Collectively, no. I don't think it did ever. It did personally for me for a short time. I got a Dear John letter from my girlfriend of the time, And that made me a bit depressed for a while. But no, I can't remember any overbearing cloud of gloom about the place.
How did you cope with the news from home?
How does one ever? You rationalise it to yourself, and I guess I can't remember very much about it at all now, but I think you have that knowledge that in a year or two you won't remember very much about it. So you store it away in your life experience box.
Can I talk to you about one or two of your colleagues? Because, I mean, you certainly met Wally Herbert. Was he there when you were there?
Yes, he was there for the whole winter.
Okay. And what did you make of him? Because he rose quite high, didn't he, in Antarctic circles?
Right, yes. I think I was always aware that he had unusual qualities. Yeah.
How do you mean?
Well, his background, he was born in India, I think, and he had already had a very varied life before he came to FIDS. And I don't know, one has this feeling about people that they are very able and creative and will do well.
Who else stands out in your memory 50-odd years later?
Hugh Simpson was another memorable character.
A doctor?
Yeah, not just because of his stuffed seal heart, but he was he was very good at his job. One of the lads, as it were. I remember, perhaps because I was a participant in it, he had various methods of relieving constipation, and I remember the shelf on which he had a row of bottles, and it was labelled Purges of Progressive Power, and I liked the alliteration.
Was constipation a occupational hazard?
Yes. I don't know whether I had it more than the others, but it's one of those things that comes up, and the sooner you can alleviate it, the better. But
and that's because of the diet, I guess. Or lack of movement, perhaps?
Yes.
Of physical exercise?
Yes, probably in the winter. Yeah. I remember Hugh's approach to sledging was that unless you're going on a very long journey, it was better not to poo until you got back. So he would go away for a week or so and then just take one of the things that was two-thirds away along the shelf and get back to normal. But I guess since he understood all that, he realised that it wouldn't do any harm. And it was much more convenient, of course, not having to poo out on the ice shelf.
Right, because it was because it was chilly.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, right, you're the first FID bold enough to mention this area of conversation. So you were recommended to actually become constipated.
No, it's what Hugh did.
He
it was his approach,
that.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. So I'm not sure how I came to know that, but certainly it would have been an example, I guess, to other people.
Did you try and follow suit?
No, I can't recall anything about that side of my sledging life. Certainly confident I didn't do anything on the 4 days of that first trip.
Fair enough. Okay. Thank you for that one. I'm picking up on some of the things you talked to Amanda about on the phone a while ago. And let's go back to the Argentinian base, because there's a story apparently about political busts.
Yes, the Argentines had a little platform on a promontory by the water where they had a flagpole and where I think the flag was raised and lowered every day. And at the four corners of this area, there were busts of four of the political leaders in Argentina. Maybe a historic figure or two, but certainly some of the current ones. And while we were there, there was a revolution in Argentina, of kind of a sort. And two of the guys who were whose busts were on this promontory fell out of favour. So their busts were broken off and thrown into the sea. But later in the year, they had a counter-revolution, I suppose, and these two guys came back into favour, whereupon they had to fish their busts out of the sea and put them back.
Did you get a sense of whether the Argentinians were doing this off their own bat or they had received instructions from Buenos Aires?
I really don't know. I imagine since the busts must have come from Argentina, they may have had some direction on, but I'm not sure.
I guess it was a source of amusement, I would think, for the Brits.
Yes, yes, for the Brits.
What other? You talked about this terrifying night at camping on the glacier in your doomed trip to Viewpoint. Were there other near misses or worrying experiences?
I only remember one other, which is when I went for a walk with a couple of dogs. And I guess I shouldn't have gone where I did. I went up the slope of Mount Flora and then I came back, as I thought to myself, along the beach. But of course, there wasn't a beach. And there was a scree slope and it went away. Quite a steep incline down to the water, and you could see it continuing below the water for quite a while. And I started to cross this slope, and every step forward was sort of half a step down, and I tried to project this trajectory across this slope and tried to estimate for myself whether I would actually get across to the other side of the scree slope before I hit the water. But I did, so that was okay, but it was a bit of a trying time, which I don't think I mentioned to anybody.
Mm. Well, there are other moments where, in retrospect, you did something that was a bit silly?
Yes, when I was doing the aerials once in the winter, they were held up with D shackles, you know, the brackets shaped like a horseshoe with a screw through the ends. And I was holding something in one hand and undoing this thing in the other. Gloves on, of course, because it was cold. And I didn't think at the time I should have put it in my pocket, but I actually put it in my mouth. And it immediately froze to my lips, but I had the presence of mind not to pull it out again, but to wait until the warmth of my lips had warmed up the metal, and then I could take it out. And all I had was a sort of small blister and discomfort for a couple of days.
You were lucky it was a small piece of metal and would warm up.
Yes.
I've heard similar stories with tacks. Tacking down felting on the roof, and you know, like any
yes,
roofer
yes.
would do, they put the tacks in their mouth, and suddenly they begin to realise that it's a bad idea.
Mm.
Yeah. At that time, there was a general policy of having half the base being changed every year, so that guys were doing 2 years, and so when the new recruits arrived, there was already half an experienced base on board, and by some form of osmosis, their experiences are transferred to the new guys to help them avoid falling into pits like that. But was that the case with you?
It was, yes. I'm not sure how much policy there was behind it, because when you go into the variations of 12 bases and 4 visits of ships during the summer, it's quite tricky to work out that kind of stuff. Certainly in my case, when I arrived, I sort of waved goodbye to the previous radio operator after half an hour. It didn't work there as far as the radio skills went. Otherwise, I think it worked pretty well. As I say, there were 3-4 ships coming in, and at each visit there was somebody left or somebody came. But as I say, I'm not sure that any great planning genius was behind it. But yes, it was osmosis, I suppose. Yes, what particularly I remember was that we had skis on the base, and nobody had skied before. And we had a book about it, and we all read it, and we put on skis, and we went out, and we all fell over and did funny things. And then at some stage in the summer, somebody arrived who could ski, and he went out and skied, and we all went out and skied because we saw somebody doing it, and we realised how you moved your legs and what muscles were involved and how the balance went, which are things you can't get from a book. But so yes, those skills are passed on by all the senses that you have.
You talk quite a lot about skiing in your diary. I wonder whether at the end of the 14 months you were passably good at it? Or?
Yeah, I think passably good is probably a good description. I've never done it since, and I long, when I'm talking to people who've been skiing, I long for them to say, "Have you ever skied?" And I say, "Only in the Antarctic."
Did it have anything to do with the Chileans at all?
Yes. At one stage, while I was at Viewpoint, a party of Chileans came across the peninsula visiting Hope Bay, and their first contact was with us at Viewpoint. And they didn't seem very confident about travelling. We walked across the ice when we saw them in the distance to greet them. And they were looking pretty miserable. One of the guys had frostbitten feet, or felt that he was getting frostbitten feet. So they stayed the night with us, and Nick and I decided we would offer this guy a sip from our half bottle of brandy, which was all that was on the base. So we sat him down, and we gave him this bottle, and while Nick was trying to find a glass or something to drink from, this guy took the top off and poured it over his foot, which was quite an eye-opener. Not that I was drinking at the time, but it has a certain... Yes, the value of brandy increases with your distance from civilization, really.
Yes. All the Finns had chosen to be there. I asked you if there was a difference between the Argentinians and the Finns. The Finns had chosen to be there. One gets the impression the Argentinians and Chileans were sent. Did you sense that? They were posted, shall we say? Because they were military, therefore they...
Yes, I didn't get that sense. I rather feel that they would have had to either volunteer or accept a challenge, a bit like in the Navy, submariners, when they go into submarines, they take a cut in pay, I believe, because it's a privilege or it's a good thing to do for your career if you go into submarines. And in the same way, I imagine, as meteorologists, if you go to the Antarctic, it's good for your career, unlike radio operators, where your career was destined for the rubbish bin anyway. But no, I didn't feel they were there unwillingly.
Also in your diaries, you describe several rather spectacular sunsets. And perhaps you could talk about that, because, of course, the sunsets were getting earlier and earlier.
Yes, and longer and longer.
Oh, really?
Okay. I remember the sun. I mean, when you're at the pole, of course, the sun appears and stays in the sky for a lot of the summer. Where we were, it was just sort of bouncing up enough to clear the horizon for a couple of hours in the middle of winter. We never actually lost sight of the sun. But during that time, where the sun was just above the horizon, it seemed to there'd be a sunset for 2 or 3 hours in the middle of the day. Yeah, in the middle of the day. So that was quite striking. And they're always different, of course, but the colours were dramatic. And we...
Were they frequent, or were they a rarity because of the... You talk in your filming about having been 20 days on which you could film in 14 months.
Yes. Yeah, sometimes there was so much cloud. Often there was so much cloud you couldn't see it. But, yeah, it was very striking. We actually had a... one of those events where you get mock suns, a parhelion, I think it is, where the sun is in the centre of a circle, and then there is another circle leading off from the top of that circle, and you can imagine the whole pattern taking up the whole sky, because this was a very clear representation of it, and there was a rainbow travelling completely around the horizon, and mock suns at various points on it. I mean, it wasn't complete, but you could see through what was there how it would have been if it was complete, which is absolutely amazing. And of course, you get your camera out and you see one tiny section of this thing, which is influencing the whole sky. But it really was quite an amazing sight.
The rainbow across the whole horizon, was this the usual arch, or was it a flattened arch?
No, straight line.
Straight line.
Straight line rainbow. Just above the horizon, all the way around.
It's That's difficult a to rare imagine. Sight, I think.
Yeah.
Did you? How was the gathering gloom? The days got shorter, and the nights got longer, and you bedded down for the winters. How were you coping with that emotionally?
it was okay. It was like the whole venture, really. I knew I was going to be involved in it for a maximum of 18 months, that I was going out in one summer, that it would get wintry and then it would get light again. So I could see the whole experience in my mind before I started, and it fitted that image that I had for it. I mean, it was more extreme in parts than I had imagined, but it all fitted the broad pattern.
So was there a changing mood in the hut as the nights overwhelmed you? You never quite had 24 hours darkness, did you? I think it was always sunlight in the day.
Sunlight, yeah. A couple of hours in the middle of the winter, over noon. Yeah, I mean, everybody slept more. We ate more. I'm less than 12 stone now. I was 14 stone after I came out of the Antarctic. Yeah, all those immediate things like sleep and eat, you did more of because there was more time in which you couldn't do anything. It's different slightly for me because I still had the radio schedules to do, but other people had less to do, and so one adjusts one's life to that in whatever way you can. You read if the generator's running.
I gather there were several problems with the generator over the time you were there, and so I guess you were without light quite a lot, were you?
I don't recall long periods of, you know, Derek Clark was very good at his job, and I had an early schedule, I used to start the generator myself. And I wasn't familiar with diesel engines, but I got the hang of it. And at one time I started the engine and it started in reverse, which can happen with diesel engines with manual turnover. You keep turning and get a good swing, a good turning of the engine, and then you press the compressor. And I must have tailed off in my energy for the swinging and pressed the compressor just before it got to top dead center or something, and it started in reverse, so all the exhaust came out of the intake, and I managed to stop it, and Derek was very constrained about all the cleaning you would have to do, taking the engine apart in part of it in order to clean the stuff before it start again. But we had to, so yeah, it was okay.
I mean, technology, of course, after you left FITS, I went on in leaps and bounds, and I think you went back to have a look at the comms room at Cambridge.
Yes, that's right.
Did you recognise anything inside it?
Not a thing. I was expecting quite a big bank of machinery, and all there was a computer and a telephone and a fax machine, I think. And it was all done by satellite, of course, and they could save everything until the conditions were right, and then just beam it all up, and all it went all over the Antarctic very quickly. So that was a great surprise. I went to visit Bass in Cambridge with Jack Hill, my namesake, although we're not related, a few years back, and that was the most surprising thing, really.
Mm-hmm.
It, it was a big office with very little in it.
Well, the office has remained the same, just that the contents have got smaller as technology's progressed. Yeah.
Mm.
How did you feel about your approaching departure from the Antarctic? Were you glad to leave, or were you sorry to return to the room?
I was quite glad to leave because it was over. The winter was over. My work was over. And I remember the biggest coming back from the Antarctic is a long process. We weren't flying in those days. So I remember the biggest change was leaving the base hut and moving onto the ship. We all got colds, which is a byproduct of that, because we'd been without germs the whole year, and as soon as the ship comes in, somebody's got a cold, and it just everybody gets it. But that was the biggest psychological change, moving from my bunk in the hut into the ship. Everything else then became gradual, but that was the biggest change. But again, enjoyable because I was travelling and getting back to what I had left, which was always going home, is always a welcome experience.
You continued to travel, I think, even after FIDS, didn't you?
Yes, I was going on a round the world trip with a friend of mine, and we thought we would go to France, get a job on a farm, save some money, and then move on and go all the way around the world. And we discovered that the easiest way, or the cheapest way to get to France, was via Jersey. So we went to Jersey, where we had about 4 hours between ships. And we found Jersey was full of French farm workers looking for work. So we thought perhaps it wasn't a good idea to go looking for farm work in France. So we stayed in Jersey. And very shortly afterwards, my friend was repatriated to England because he was discovered taking pennies out of toilet doors in public conveniences. So that knocked that on the head. And I stayed in Jersey and did a little trip in France afterwards. But I've done various bits of travelling since then and enjoyed it. I went to Canada and America for 5 months. And shortly after I came back from the Antarctic, I have family over there. So I was travelling around, visiting various bits of family for quite a long time.
What happened to your career?
Well, radio operators work on the way out as far as working life is concerned, because more and more communications was being done automatically. It's a bit like cars. When they first came out, everybody had a chauffeur to drive it for them. After a time, they discovered how easy it was to drive, so they did it themselves. But I realised that the skills that I had, which were Morse, which didn't have a very great future, and typing, which did have a future of a kind. But when I came back, it wasn't until some time afterwards, I realised that the thing I had been doing a lot of in my life was writing the diary in the Antarctic. And when I went to America, I wrote articles for my local newspaper. So I began to think that perhaps journalism would be a good thing to do. So I got a job in Fleet Street with the Press Association, but I was what's called a telephone reporter. Reporters would go out on stories and they would phone in their stories to Fleet Street, and they would dictate it to people like me, and I would type it from dictation. again, it's another dying skill, because reporters now email their stories into head office. But I was working in a news environment, which I thoroughly enjoyed. And it was shift work, which I also enjoyed. Having days off in midweek in the summer was great. But I had seen that job as a step towards journalism, but it wasn't. I was in the wrong union. And so I married in 1962. My wife very bravely was working at the time and suggested that I took a year off to do some GCSEs full time, which I did, and I got my qualifications in English and applied for journalist jobs for 6 months before I found a job on a little trade magazine, and went on from there. Not as far as I wanted to, because I really wanted to work on a newspaper. But I was in the trade press because of my slightly technical background. But it was interesting. I used to go and see people who had just bought computers. I would be paid by the person who'd sold them the computer. So they never sent me to a client they'd have problems with. and my job was to write up the story of how they'd bought this computer and how marvellous it was and what they've been able to do with it.
That mean you had to understand computers yourself?
No, I've never been a very technical person, but I seemed to be able to understand what computers did rather than how they did it.
Right.
So I could appreciate how they could do a company's accounts, for instance, with a lot less manual input. So I did quite a lot of that at a time when computers, in the 70s, when computers were just beginning to come into companies, and I would write a story about a lampshade manufacturer who bought a computer to do his accounting, and I'd say how they got on with it, and then that story would go into the lampshade manufacturer's weekly newspaper or monthly, and it would spread the story about how fine computers were. But I really tried to look for problems, because I felt, okay, you can write a story saying how marvellous computers are, but if you write a story saying, I thought computers were marvellous, but I came across this problem. And if you write it like that, and then you write how the problem was solved, then it's more understandable and better for the computer company as well. So I then got into more and more technical stuff, and then I went freelance in public relations, which is something that a lot of journalists do. They go into public relations because the money's better. And I got into technical things like ground probing radar, where a brilliant man had developed this system where he could detect landmines with a technology that had been previously quite easy, because landmines were made of metal and you could find them in a metal detector. But they're now, or they were then, about 98% plastic, so difficult to find. But he had developed this system, so I did publicity for that company and others. So that was quite a challenging job. And as a freelance, which I enjoyed, but which my wife didn't, because we never knew how much money we'd earn in a year. And it was difficult to get learned. So, yes, that was a continuing challenge, which I quite enjoy.
Did you stay in journalism all you work, for your working life?
From that time, yes. Yeah. From when I was 35.
You've done some lecturing about the Antarctic, haven't you, at some point, or talking about it?
Yes. When I came back, I had a letter from the Commonwealth Institute. I think it was still called the Imperial Institute then, explaining that they had a panel of lecturers on each country of the Commonwealth, and they would, and since I'd been to the Antarctic, which very few people had, would I consider giving lectures for them? And I immediately put the letter on one side and thought, no, I'm not, it's not for me, I can't lecture. But then I had my film developed and put it together and found I couldn't stop talking about it. So I did, went to schools for the Commonwealth Institute for 3 terms and thoroughly enjoyed it. They put me in a hotel for in a town, and I would do 3 or 4 lectures a day showing my film, which I took the projector around with me, and the screen. It was great. I get all the rewards of teaching, like the oohs and the ahs and the interest in the subject. And then at the end of the lesson, I would go. Not have to give the homework out and all that.
Did you ever get to go back to the Antarctic?
No, I did. I did think about it when these tourist ships started to go down there, and particularly when I discovered, well, even quite recently, there are tall ships going to the Antarctic in the summer. That I found very attractive. But then I thought, well, I haven't been to the Arctic, so if I'm going to go to polar regions again, I'd like to go there. And last year I got to hear of a trip on a Russian icebreaker that goes through the Northwest Passage, which I was very interested in. But I had a hip operation about that time, so I've put it off. But maybe still do it.
I just want to finish off by asking you how your Antarctic experience shaped or changed your life. We've already talked quite a bit about how it began the transition from Baptist to atheist, if that's the correct way of putting it. Were there any other lasting effects on you, you think?
I don't know. I was reading quite a lot before I went to the Antarctic, and I read a lot in the Antarctic, and I think that developed my interest in English and how to express things. I'm much happier at a keyboard than I am at a microphone. I tend to think at the same speed at which I type, so it's a more direct link, where others have that kind of immediacy between their brain and their tongue. I don't have that, but it's a fluency in writing that I think developed while I was in the Antarctic.
Unless there's anything else you particularly wanted to say, I think you've covered the ground beautifully. Thank you very much.
Good. Well, I'd just like to mention that we're sitting in my house, and out of the window is an 18th century building called Bank House, where Samuel Gurney Cresswell was born. And he was the guy who was in the McClure expedition looking for Franklin in the 1850s, and I've got interested in his life and in that whole period because of my Antarctic experience, but also being so close to where he lived. And I was fascinated to read a month ago that the ship on which Samuel Gurney Cresswell arrived in the Northwest Passage, and which he had to abandon and was crushed in the ice and sank, that ship has recently been rediscovered by Canadian archaeologists. So we should have some nice imagery of it eventually. They're not going to raise it, but it's been well preserved in Mercy Bay, where they stay. But he was the first person, or one of three people, who actually went through the Northwest Passage, although not in a ship, in 1853. So I find that whole period very interesting.
Ken, thank you very much.
Okay.